is VOA News. I'm Gene Randall. Spain is preparing to follow Italy's example by declaring a nationwide lockdown because of the new coronavirus. The Associated Press reports the government in Madrid plans to announce a two-week state of emergency and strict limits on movements by the country's 46 million people. They'll be allowed out of their homes only to buy food and medicine, to go to work, to hospitals and banks, and to take trips related to the care of the young and the elderly. In Vatican City, when Pope Francis recites the Angelus Prayer tomorrow, it'll be live-streamed in a break with centuries-old tradition. This as coronavirus deaths in Italy approach 1,300, with more than 17,000 confirmed cases. Mayors of Italian cities, including Rome and Milan, have closed public parks, adding to the country's lockdown conditions. Here in Washington, U.S. President Donald Trump says he has taken a coronavirus test. No result yet. And the White House has just begun conducting temperature checks for anyone who is in close contact with either the president or his vice president, Mike Pence. The test is called a move taken out of an abundance of caution. We have a report from the AP's Ben Thomas.
The White House says the move is being taken out of an abundance of caution. President Trump has had multiple direct and indirect contacts with people who have tested positive for COVID-19. Last weekend at his private club in Florida, the president spent time with at least three people. Brazil's chargé d'affaires, who sat at Trump's dinner table, as well as a top aide to Brazil's president. Republican officials say the third person attended a fundraiser with Trump last Sunday. For most people, the new coronavirus causes only mild or moderate symptoms, such as fever and cough, but for some it can cause severe illness, such as pneumonia. Ben Thomas, Washington.
The UK and Ireland on Monday will be added to a list of countries not allowed to carry foreign nationals into the United States. The U.S. travel ban on most flights from Europe is part of the effort to stem the spread of the coronavirus. Americans and permanent U.S. residents are exempt from the ban. From Washington, this is VOA News. In a message to the world, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says it's time for all nations to declare war on the coronavirus. He also talked about the likely economic impact of the pandemic.
United Nations economists estimate that the virus could cost the global economy at least $1 trillion this year, and perhaps more. No country can do it alone. More than ever, governments must cooperate to revitalize economies.
And Guterres talked about virus fallout impacts.
The social and economic fallout from the combination of the pandemic and slowing economies will affect most of us for some months. But the spread of the virus will peak, our economies will recover, and until then, we must act together.
Iran says it's being forced to seek loans to help it deal with its large-scale coronavirus outbreak. The AP's Sarah Bassett has our report.
Iran has asked the International Monetary Fund for a $5 billion loan to fight the new coronavirus. It's the first time since the 1979 Islamic Revolution that Iran has sought such assistance, as well as a staggering admission of how fragile its economy has become amid the epidemic, U.S. sanctions, and plunging oil prices. The last time a loan for Iran was approved from the IMF was under its final Shah in 1960. Iran's health ministry says the outbreak has killed another 97 people, pushing the death toll in the country to over 600. I'm Sarah Bassett.
A barrage of rockets today hit an Iraqi base where U.S.-led coalition forces are stationed. Five coalition members and two Iraqi soldiers were reportedly wounded. A coalition spokesman said 25 rockets hit the base. The unusual daytime assault on Camp Taji came just days after a similar attack on the base killed two American service members and a British medic, wounding at least 14 others. After Taji was hit on Wednesday, U.S. airstrikes hit five weapons depots of the Iranian-backed group Kataib Hezbollah in Iraq. An official of the U.N. mission in the West African nation of Mali says two people who were kidnapped in neighboring Burkina Faso in December 2018 have been released. They are Canadian Edith Blaze and Italian Luca Tacchetto. They were found near Kidal in northern Mali and were turned over to UN peacekeepers. They are said to be in good health. New Zealand today called off a national service marking the one-year anniversary of the attack on two Christchurch mosques that took 51 lives. The coronavirus is the reason why. The event was expected to attract a large crowd and many traveling from around New Zealand and overseas. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said in a statement, "This is a pragmatic decision. We're very saddened to cancel. But in remembering such a terrible tragedy, we should not create the risk of further harm being done." Gene Randall, VOA News.
Nightline Africa, we are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Totti in Washington, D.C.
And we want to assure you that there's no political party in this in Malawi that can beat DPP. By the way, we won the 2019 elections fair and square, but just because justice and law have become distant cousins in Malawi.
The Malawian ruling party remains confident of winning the upcoming presidential election rerun.
Le Minedu compte plus de 43 écoles expérimentales multilingues.
She says the Ministry of Basic or Elementary Education is experimenting with the teaching of 5 national languages in 43 schools throughout Cameroon.
Cameroon commemorates International Mother Language Day.
Children between 8 to 12 are being sensitized, initiated, and the practice takes effect from that time. These are basically babies who have taken to schools for empowerment, for purposes of full growth, to actualize their potential.
And Ugandan Minister for Gender and Culture faces backlash over a recent pronouncement. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP, says it is confident incumbent President Arthur Peter Mutharika will win the upcoming May 19 presidential election rerun. This, despite a forged alliance between the main opposition Malawi Congress Party, or MCP, led by Dr. Lazarus Chakwera, and the United Transformation Movement, or UTM, led by incumbent Vice President Dr. Saulos Chilima, ahead of the vote. Both opposition groups challenged the outcome of last year's presidential election, which led to the annulment of the results by the Constitutional Court. Malawi Home Affairs Minister Nicholas Dawusi, who is also the spokesperson for the ruling DPP, tells me he remains confident that President Mutharika will win the upcoming poll.
The advantage is that we have worked together with UDF for the past 5 years, so it's just a continuation, and Malawians have benefited from that alliance.
Looking at the presidential election rerun, what do you think is the best selling point for your party ahead of the election?
Well, it's a loaded question. I think people would want to see tangible developments, and the developments are the ones that we are doing. And we think we will continue.
So are you concerned about the possible alliance of the opposition against your party?
No. Alliances are part of the democratic processes, and as it regards to other political parties, let them make their own alliance. We'll meet on the ground.
What is the level of your preparation in terms of campaigning for the next election?
100% prepared, and we want to assure you that there's no political party in Malawi that can beat DPP. No, you can't. By the way, we won the 2019 elections, fair and square, but just because justice and law have become distant cousins in Malawi.
So you think the ruling was a mistake, perhaps?
The ruling was, we think there was some, but we are not satisfied. That's the bottom line.
Does that mean that you've put measures in place to ensure that this time around, if you win, there will be no ambiguity at all about it?
There will be no ambiguity whatsoever. In fact, let me tell you, whether any other political party will bound together themselves, we are going to prevail. But we will put up a very electoral campaign that you ain't seen nothing yet, but we can assure you that Malawi, the bottom line is Malawi will continue. So, by the way, I don't think Malawians can vote for a political party that has sponsored hoodlums, thugs, stormtroopers, looters, people of men, killed a police officer, millions of dollars burned to ashes. I don't think people can elect such leaders I don't think so, no.
What makes you so confident that the DPP will win the election again?
Extremely confident. That's what the people are telling us. If you were in Malawi, I told you that let's go to Lilongwe today, let's go to Zuzu today, they will tell you that, wait a minute, my Congress party and UTM has sponsored the violence. They killed the police officers. They undressed the women. They looted. They sponsored looters, stormtroopers, thugs. We have, well, we have kept quiet. So people say, look, these are the people that are looking at Malawi as a country. And that's what we will continue to do, and that's what people want. Malawians are very peaceful people. This alien culture of killing a police officer is never heard in Malawi, and people cannot allow anybody to introduce this kind of savagery, no.
But what do you say to these civil society organizations and opposition groups who say that supporters of the DPP are to blame and that the security officers or the police are biased and allow the DPP partisans or supporters to attack them without any recourse?
You must tell the supporters right there in Washington that they should not sponsor thugs, not giving money to thuggery, hoodlums. And there is no way they can say that it's DPP. These people were MCPs sponsored by my Congress party, sponsored by UTM. And the president of UTM was there, leading the demonstrators. So the president of UTM was there, leading demonstrators. And after that, they killed a police officer. And after killing a police officer, the president of my Congress party, 3 weeks ago, went to Sunde, where a police officer was killed, and he praised the people for doing a job all the time. Can they say that we ask? No.
So those perpetrators of those acts that you described about, what is happening to them now?
Those small boys that were caught in our stores and charges, and I hope the court will make right punishment to them as a deterrent.
So what is the DPP message to the people of Malawi ahead of the election?
Let's continue to be peaceful. Malawi is the only country that God gave us. Differences, democracy is the diversity of opinion. Our diversity of opinion should not be a source of confrontation, hatred, killing, or violence. It must be a source of unity to develop the country. We can't afford a poor country to burn the little we have. It's terrible.
Nicholas Dawusi is the Malawian Home Affairs Minister and spokesperson for the ruling DPP. He spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Cameroon recently commemorated International Mother Language Day by launching what it calls an ambitious program to save its endangered national languages. The Central African country has over 260 national languages, but only 40 are taught in schools. Cameroonians speak mostly French and English, which are foreign but official languages and part of an entrenched separatist conflict that has cost about 3,000 lives since 2017. For VOA, Moki Ebren Kezeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
At the multilingual and inclusive government primary school Yaoundé, 150 children between the ages of 5 and 11 years old learn how to count in Ewondo, a Cameroon national language spoken in the country's central and southern regions that comprise two of the Central African state's 10 administrative regions. The students are also taught the national anthem and patriotic songs in Cameroon national languages. Many parents are in the school to see how their children learn to speak in the Ewondo language. 31-year-old businessman Emmanuel Mbom says he is satisfied at the progress made by his 6-year-old son, since he is unable to teach his children at home.
In my situation, my wife and I speak two different languages, native languages, so my children try to pick what they can pick.
Mbom says he is confused about which language to teach his children because his language is Sawa, spoken in the littoral and southwest regions of Cameroon, and his wife is from the northwestern town of Nkambe, where the Limbum language is spoken. Cameroon's Secretary of State in the Ministry of Basic Education, Asheri Kilu, says she is satisfied with the level of interest the children display at speaking their national language.
It is very impressive the way the children are taken into learning their languages. And I decided to check how many children are from other regions rather than Yaoundé. And I figured that there were children from all the 10 regions in Cameroon.
Cameroon has 260 national languages spoken by an estimated 25 million people in the 10 regions of the country. It is one of the countries the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, classifies as a distinctive cultural density on the linguistic map of the world. The Central African state, however, inherited two foreign languages from its French and English colonial masters as official languages, with 80% of the population speaking French and 20% English. Fabien Freeland, Director General of the non-governmental organization Summer Institute of Linguistics, that helps Cameroon in promoting the teaching and learning of its national languages, says the official languages have not been effective tools of communication.
French and English has its limit for impact on development in this country. When there was a cholera outbreak in the far north, it's only when the information started coming in Fufude that people started changing behavior and the cholera was stopped.
Cameroon's National Institute of Statistics reports that 4% of the Central African state's local languages, including the Mbiamin language, spoken in the country's English-speaking northwest region, and the Ekong language in the south have disappeared since 1950. 10% of the 260 languages are neglected, and 7% are threatened. Seraphine Ben Bolli, who heads the program to promote the use of Cameroon national languages, says to save the remaining mother tongues from disappearing, they have initiated a pilot program that is being implemented in the 10 regions of the country.
L'Omineju compte plus de 43 écoles expérimentales multilingues.
She says the Ministry of Basic or Elementary Education is experimenting with the teaching of 5 national languages in 43 schools throughout Cameroon. She says the languages chosen for now include Ehundu, Bassa, Douala, Womala, and Fufudi because of their national popularity. She says apart from the experimental schools, teachers in all educational establishments have received instructions and training to teach Cameroon national languages spoken in the areas where their schools are found. Bolli said Cameroon will by 2030 decide on which of the languages can be used as an official language added to English and French. She said by so doing, they intend to solve the separatist crisis that has within the past 4 years claimed at least 3,000 lives just because people are divided as a result of 2 inherited colonial languages. Separatists have been fighting to create an English-speaking state out of the French-speaking majority. The separatists say the education, legal system and cultural practices they inherited from their British colonial masters are different from those left by the French, who colonized the French-speaking regions of the country. Cameroon believes by having its own national language as an official language, many of its citizens will feel like Cameroonians, unlike in the past when they considered themselves either French or English. UNESCO says it celebrates Mother Tongue Day because it believes in the importance of cultural and linguistic diversity for sustainable societies, and it is within its mandate for peace that it works to preserve the differences in cultures and languages that foster tolerance and respect for others. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Last week, one Kenyan died and 12 others were wounded when two rival military factions from Somalia fought on Kenyan territory. Locals say the Jubaland militia had crossed into Kenya a month earlier, pursued by the Somali military. Analysts warn that continued tensions between the two countries are threatening broader security in the region. For VOA, Ryal Ombor reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Leaders from the region say tensions on the Kenya-Somalia border have been simmering for a while and that Kenya's national government has failed to pay attention. They voiced their concerns Friday during a press conference in Nairobi. Among them, Ali Roba, governor of the Kenyan border town of Mandera. He spoke of the trouble in Somalia's semi-autonomous state of Jubaland, where the Somali military has been involved in clashes with fighters linked to Ahmed Badobi, president of Jubaland region.
Over the last 1 month, there has been a major fallout between the regional government of Jubaland and the federal government of Somalia. On Monday, the 2nd of March, the two forces attacked each other with unknown casualties on both sides, but left 12 people injured in Mandera town due to stray bullets, where one succumbed to the injury.
Officials in Mandera also say a number of people, fearing for their safety, fled to safer areas because of the violence. Also this week, Somali media reported that Somali President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo spoke by phone with Kenyan counterpart Uhuru Kenyatta regarding security and that they agreed to work together on their common interests. Kenya's president had accused Somalia of a flagrant breach of Kenya's territorial integrity. Kenya shares a 682-kilometer border with Somalia and has in the past attempted to secure parts of it by building a fence. There have been concerns that terrorists may take advantage of the porous border. Robert says the situation along the border has Kenyans questioning whether their government can adequately protect them. He says the government needs to expel people whom he calls foreigners from Mandera.
The situation taking shape in Mandera County is that of eroded public trust in their own government as a result of neglect, misplaced priority, and putting the interest of external region over and above that of its own citizens. We refuse to accept that the interest of other external entities supersede that of our population. We therefore demand that our government expels these foreign forces from Mandera with immediate effect.
Regional leaders also asked the national government for humanitarian help for the hundreds of internally displaced persons. Meanwhile, Kenya is considering pulling out of the African Union mission in Somalia after 8 years of fighting the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. The Al-Qaeda-linked group has attacked Kenya for its involvement in supporting the AU mission in Somalia. Kenya has also hosted thousands of Somali refugees who fled civil war in their country. Ryal Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Ugandan Minister for Gender and Culture is facing a backlash after equating the cultural practice of labia stretching with female circumcision, known as female genital mutilation, because of the damage caused. The traditional stretching of the female genitals by Bantu-speaking ethnic groups in Uganda, Rwanda, and Zambia is believed to have benefits, including greater sexual pleasure. But the pre-marriage practice is criticized for being forced on young girls, as Halima Atumani reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. First, a warning to listeners. This story includes content of a sexual nature and descriptions that some may find disturbing.
Cynthia, who for privacy does not wish to use her real name, was 12 years old when a senior female teacher announced that girls at her school, more than 100, would undergo genital stretching. Under pressure from the girls' parents, the school arranged for older women to instruct the girls on how to stretch their labia and to use traditional herbs to make it permanent.
It was painful. It wasn't really something pleasant for me as a person, because at that time you were something like 12 years, 11 years, you're not sexually active. So why are you doing this thing? Honestly, why are you doing this so-called pulling, whatever people call it? I didn't know why. But because we're many, some days they would say, get a partner. Get a partner, you do it to each other.
Labia stretching is a pre-marriage tradition in southeastern Africa among Bantu-speaking tribes who believe it gives greater sexual pleasure to both men and women. But Uganda's Minister for Culture and Gender, Peace Mutuzo, sparked controversy this month by calling labia stretching a type of female genital mutilation. She says while FGM that involves cutting or circumcision does much greater physical damage, labia stretching should not be forced on girls.
Children between 8 to 12 are being sensitized, initiated, and the practice takes effect from that time. These are basically babies who have taken to schools for empowerment, for purposes of full growth, to actualize their potential.
For the last 20 years, Hamida Namatavu has been showing girls and women how to stretch their labia. She defends the cultural practice, claiming, unlike FGM, labia stretching has no negative effects, only positive ones. She says, once you do it and you have a marriage partner, that's the only thing that will show him that you are ready. But doctors dismiss the claims. Dr. Vincent Karhanga says, just like FGM, labia stretching is more about pleasing men than women.
Much as it is claimed that pulling can ease birth pain or even make a woman warmer, there is no scientific evidence in this. But what is true is that pulling can actually make the men involved sexually with the women happier with their sexual act.
Nonetheless, labia stretching practitioners are demanding that Mutuzo apologize for undermining their tradition. But she dismisses their call, saying she will continue to speak for the voiceless and discourage the practice until girls reach the age of consent. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
The European Union outlined Monday a new partnership with Africa that seeks to build a more equal relationship between the two sides. From UAE, Lisa Bryan has more from Paris.
The strategy is still in the bare-bones stage. Many details still need filling in, including financial ones. European Union officials say they will be looking for feedback from African counterparts in the run-up to an EU-Africa summit later this year. But the EU's executive arm has outlined five key focus areas: transitioning to and accessing green energy, the digital transformation, sustainable growth and jobs, peace, security, and governance, and migration and mobility. EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell says overall the bloc wants to scale up its partnership with Africa and make it more effective.
We have geopolitical interests in Africa. Our growth and security depends on what happens in Africa, maybe more than in any other part of the world.
While the EU is not always seen as a financial heavyweight in Africa, the 27-member bloc together is a source of more than $250 billion in foreign investment on the continent, compared to $48 billion from the United States and $43 billion from China. Borrell says current European support also includes helping African nations cope with the global coronavirus outbreak and more broadly strengthening their health systems. Reuters reports some aid agencies worry European efforts to staunch migration risk undermining the bloc's new partnership strategy. But that was not the message Brussels sent out Monday. Borrell said the EU's new strategy aimed not to see Africa simply within the prism of migration. He said while it was necessary to fight against illegal migration, legal migration should turn into a win-win for both sides. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Cote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, this Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. Right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Upon the atal when pity, we will take Goya Goya, Palabella doing it.
naipa. Yote unapanda, iyo utavuna. Banji babateo, ngakwe bolimo. Wewe wale sobita bu, hola buse. Apande sipigani na we, nakupigania. Sipigani na we, lakini nakupigania. Apande siruana na we, be, manirira kwe. Apande sipigani na we, nakupigania. Sipigani na we, lakini nakupigania. Apande siruana na we, be, manirira kwe. Tiruana ni we, mukagwa, manirira iwe. Apande sipigani na we, nakupigania. Sipigani na we, lakini nakupigania. Apande siruana na we.
It's Mr. Coker.
Come for now and do that.
I'm genyone, anema famina, non se ma genyone, de po anyati wo, non se ma genyone, in anema famiso e, non se ma genyone wo, de po anyati wo.
Baby super, nasi tima yeguanja kira. Baby care, baby super, awaka bitu ni ningana.
Yo yo, unja chiren,
yo yo,
undanga kapiro,
yo yo,
untana miro miro,
wata,
undanga miro miro,
wata,
unja chiren,
yo yo,
undanga kapiro,
yo yo,
untana miro miro,
wata,
undanga miro miro,
wata.
You're my woman song, sweetie, my soldier. You're my woman song.
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, producer Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer for today, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when the shepherd comes home in peace, the milk is sweeter. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa. Thank you.